This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. With the violent conflicts in the Middle East, such as in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, the terrorist attacks across Europe, and the discourse of banning Muslims from entering America in the presidential election, these are challenging times to be a Muslim in America. With this past weekend marking the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, many Muslim Americans continue to feel widespread misunderstanding about their faith. For example, the notion that Islam is inherently associated with terrorism. It's why many American Muslims say that they fear the future. Well, this week, the Hinckley Institute of Politics hosted a panel discussion about what it means to be Muslim living in America. The panelists include Dr. Sohaila Amir Soleimani. She's an associate professor of Persian in the Department of World Languages at the University of Utah. She also teaches courses about Middle Eastern culture and Islamic culture. Amal Sharif is an executive board member of the Muslim Students Association at the University of Utah. And Amir Abdelghani is acting president of the Muslim Student Association, and he's originally from Egypt. This discussion was moderated by Jennifer Napier Pierce, the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. And again, this discussion was recorded earlier this week on Monday, September 12th.
I guess I want to start with each of you. When people find out that you're a practicing Muslim, what is their first question to you? And I'll start with you, Amal.
Usually they first ask about my scarf, and I don't know, they always ask, like, do I wear it all the time? Do I sleep in it? And, like, stuff like that. But they're always asking, like, whether I do or don't like the scarf.
Do you want to explain? I was going to do this later, but maybe we can just interject.
Sure.
So we've heard about burkini bans in France and questions about the hijab. Maybe you can explain what Muslim women wear and why.
So the hijab is a veil that we wear over our heads. It's part of. It's a requirement that we wear it. Usually it starts around like 10 or 12. I started when I was a kid. But
that's flexible? You get to decide when you're ready to wear it?
You get to decide when you want to wear it. It's usually recommended that you start younger, so that would be easier for you to learn. But also, it's a sign of modesty. And the hijab is not just the veil that you wear, it's also the clothing you wear and the way you act and the way you treat people. And the idea of banning, or what do you call it, making it so that the burqa is banned, you're saying that you're trying to stop women from being oppressed. You're forcing us to decide what we can and can't wear. I feel like that's counterintuitive in and of itself.
So answering the question, what people want to know. So do you wear it all the time? Do you sleep in it?
I usually just wear it whenever I'm outside of the house in front of males that are not part of my family. But whenever I'm with like friends or family, I take it off.
Okay, thanks. Amir, what's that question that everybody wants to know about your beliefs?
So when they know that I'm a practicing Muslim, it depends a lot on how close is that person to me. So when we break the barriers between each other, they start to ask about, you know, do you Muslims believe in that? Why Muslims are doing that? All of that stuff. But for a person that I met by chance at the bus, he wouldn't ask in deep questions because he just, okay, yeah, that's cool. So where are you from? I'm from that country. I'm from Egypt, actually, by the way. So I'm from Egypt. Wow, so you guys have the pyramids. Yes, we have. And most of the questions will go to the direction of culture. Where are you from? Where do you advise me to visit when I go to your country? All of those stuff. So it's not in depth, you know, whenever they ask, it's not that.
So no questions of faith or beliefs?
So the questions of faith or belief, they generally happen when I'm attending an event like this event, multicultural event, people question and answer. I really like, I'm coming today wishing to hear questions from the audience about my beliefs or what do you think. And also those questions that happens of my belief when I'm talking with a close friend of mine, he's just talking to me, what do you guys, why your religion is different like that? Why you guys have a lot of people? Whenever we find a terrorist, he's a Muslim. But, you know, and then, yeah, such those questions, you know.
We will certainly get into that in a moment. Professor Amir Soleimani, what is the question that you're asked most often?
Introduction to Islam?
Yes.
It's because I teach about Muslim Americans and Muslim mysticism, I think it's a little bit different for me. I mean, just a funny story that I have is at some point I lived in the Bay Area and I went to the dentist, and my hygienist, you know, was, you know, so I'm in the dentist's chair, right? So, you know, I'm kind of completely immobile. And she was asking me actually about the modest dress of Muslim women. And, you know, just in terms of, it was an interesting exchange just because of the fact that it's very hard to kind of have, hold a conversation.
Yeah.
It's so funny because, you know, I now live in Salt Lake City and I have a wonderful dentist. I recommend him to everyone. And he and I have very heated debates when I go to see him, you know, and some of them involve things related to Islam. But he's very curious. He's genuinely curious and interested to learn about Muslim Americans, about Muslim mysticism, you know. And, you know, it's you know, politically we are very different, but at the same time it's, you know, very genuine curiosity on his part.
Mm.
And it's always very interesting because I'm kind of immobile on the, you know, on the dentist chair.
Captive audience.
Right, exactly. I'm a kind of a, it's you know, it's usually very interesting. But in my case, because I teach about Islam, I think, you know, probably it's a little bit different than Amal and Amr. You know, because I have students who come to my classes and they're genuinely interested. And, you know, of course, it's a very emotive topic, you know, especially this year, considering the presidential elections. You know, I just finished in the spring 2016 teaching Muslim Americans, which is also a diversity class, in case anybody needs a diversity class. And it was within the context of, you know, obviously very emotive debates going on in the country.
Again, we're going to get to that. But what are the misconceptions about your religion? There's a lot of misunderstanding and erroneous beliefs. What are you each confronted with? Do you want to start, Professor?
Obviously the thing that Am mentioned, which is that inevitably Islam is equated with terrorism and terrorists. So that's a huge one. Another one I would say is the notion that some of the young terrorists we have seen around the world, you know, including in this country, they are radicalized Muslim. And this is something that I, you know, try and disabuse my students or anybody I encounter. I would like to disabuse them from this notion that they are, in fact, what we see in the media called radicalized Muslim.
Is this a language issue? I mean, what's wrong with calling it radicalized? I mean, that separates it from mainstream Islam and, you know, peaceful believing people. But when you have an organization named the Islamic State, I think there's just a natural assumption and connection that goes with that sort of violence. I mean, what is wrong with calling it radicalized?
Yeah, that's a very good question. In my mind, and in relation to this, there's a fantastic person that, you know, and a lot of you who are political science majors might be interested in reading. His name is Olivier Roy, and I really like how he addresses it, which is, you know, we're not talking about young people who all of a sudden discovered Islam. You know, let's say as hyphenated French Muslims, American Muslims, Belgian Muslims, and so forth. We're talking about people who are not Muslim, but were, in fact, in their youth, radicalized. That's really what we're talking about. But what they do is they basically co-opt some of the narratives of Islam without at all practicing Islam. That's the difference.
Okay. Anything to add, Amar? Amal, no?
Well, that looks a little deep for me because I'm an international student here.
You get the questions, though.
Yeah. So,
so are all Muslims terrorists? How do you answer?
So I answer that by saying that the people who are terrorists do not know the Quran. And if they know the Quran is a holy book for Muslims. And this is the reference one for all Muslims all over the world. So those are the books of God, books of Allah. These are the words of Allah. And we should obey those words of Allah. Allah mentioned in Quran in chapter 5, verse 32, that Allah is saying that whoever kills one soul, not a result of killing another soul, it's not soul by soul. They just kill a soul for the corruption on earth. They are as if they kill the whole mankind. And whoever saves one soul, as if he saved the whole mankind. So understanding this verse that was mentioned in Quran, that you cannot kill an innocent person just because, you know, for corruption or just saying that I'm strong or for causing terror among people or causing terror for government by killing its citizens, all of those stuff, any killing for any person by that mean, as if you kill the whole mankind, as if you kill like 6.5 billion person. And this was mentioned by God in Quran. And the same applies for whoever saves one soul. It's not by killing. It's if you are saving a soul, if you are helping someone to be alive, if you are doing anything to save a person's life, it is for God, as if you save the whole mankind. So I tell them that this is a verse in Quran, and this is what I believe in Quran, and I obey and apply the second part of it to prove the correction of the first part of it. So saving a life, this is what I have been focused since I came here, that whenever I want to convince someone I'm saving lives, okay, I'm donating platelets on a regular basis. Whenever I'm donating platelets, I'm saving a life. So if someone is telling me, okay, what you did for saving a life, okay, I'm a regular donor for platelets. I organize with Muslim Student Association and with the Associated Student of University of Utah, the ASU, we have been organizing with them over the past 2 years the annual blood drive in University of Utah. And we are coordinating and doing everything with them. And this year is going to be the third year we are collaborating with the ASU at the annual blood drive. And this comes from our belief and our religion. Whoever saves one soul, it is as if he saved the whole mankind.
So where are these radicalized terrorists? They say they are also being obedient to the words of Allah. So where's the justification there?
So my justification as a person came from the Middle East. Egypt actually is the largest country at the Middle East. If you look to the Middle East, there are like 300 million. The Egyptians are 90 million, which is like one-third of the population there. So for me as Egyptian, and I have seen a lot of radicalized guys from Egypt, and even the second or the leader of Al-Qaeda now is Ayman Zawahiri, he's Egyptian. And even the person who did the attacks of 9/11, the leader of the attacks, he was Egyptian. So I see in Egypt as a country, whenever I see people who are radicalized, I understand because I understand my culture, I understand my country. That in my country, 40% from the people are illiterate. They cannot read or write. And it's the government have been, and this is a little politically, I'm speaking outside of the shoes of the Muslim Student Association. I'm just speaking as an Egyptian student. So the government have been for over the past 6 years trying to increase that illiteracy and trying to use their religion in controlling the people. So the governments that we see in the Middle East, I'm calling my country, I'm not calling the other countries, although they apply on the same rule, they are using the religion in controlling the people. and telling the people, whoever is not obeying the president, not obeying the king, he's disobeying to God, he's disobeying to Allah. And whoever is trying to turn around that president or king as if he's turning around against God. And when they look to the president or the king, they are so corrupted. They do not apply anything related to Islam, which is the basic thing, is having justice and freedom. So it's really strange that me as a person, I'm 32 years old, and the first time I came here to America, 2009, I stayed for 2 years in North Carolina, 2009 to 2011, with my wife. And the first time for me to feel like freedom when I came here, when I stayed to that country. And when I came here, I understand, wow, so they just, I was not living before. Even that shape of me having beard, my long beard, I'm that shape of a Muslim. And I'm sorry for the strange beard, but we do not cut our beard or we do not make it look more nice unless we until we do the sacrifice. And we do now, we have now the feast. It's called the Feast of Al-Adha. It's today, actually. And the Feast of Al-Adha, we do sacrifice. This is long back to Prophet Abraham. And we do not cut our beard until we do the sacrifice or have a bit of shape, our mustache, all of that stuff, until we do that. So having a beard in my country, since I was born, is something, you know, something dangerous for a person. Because they arrest you, and the rule they apply it in Egypt, in my country, that you are a criminal until you prove that you are innocent.
So what I hear you saying is that there is the government intervention in religious practice,
yes,
is influencing and perhaps even fueling this terrorist mentality.
I agree 100%, because whenever you play with the religion as a weapon and use it for controlling people, others will use the same weapon in getting around you. And they will bring evidence that, you know, they are wrong. Let's use the religion in the correct way, and the religion saying, let's kill whoever is not applying the rules of God or whoever is forcing people to disbelieve in God. This is what was mentioned. If people are forcing you to disbelieve in God, then fight them or leave them. So this was the start of everything radicalized, I would say, in my country. This is my personal point of view, and I'm pushing that this do not represent the Muslim Student Association, because we have people from different countries. So Amal here, she's an American Muslim, I'm Egyptian, and we have almost like students from like 30 different countries here at the U.
That was Amir Abdelghani, the acting president of the Muslim Student Association at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW and a panel discussion recorded earlier this week about being Muslim in America. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, and we replay them, unedited, in their entirety, as a public service. Today we're airing a forum recorded on Monday this week about being Muslim in America. The panelists include Dr. Sohaila Amir Soleimani, an associate professor of Persian in the Department of World Languages at the University of Utah, Amal Sharif, an executive board member of the Muslim Student Association at the U, and Amir Abdelghani, he's the acting president of the Muslim Student Association. And the discussion was moderated by Jennifer Napier Pierce, the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune.
Amal, since you grew up in the U.S., I'm curious about this question, and there are critical voices out there who say, well, terrorists have been linked to Islam. These terrorists are claiming allegiance to this religion. Why aren't Muslim leaders speaking out more against these heinous acts? And maybe it requires a little bit of explanation about how the Muslim religion is... Is there a hierarchy? I mean, how is it organized?
So technically speaking, you are your own person. You are your own advocate. You are your own Muslim. So one of the rules is, however you get closer to God is through the Quran, and you try your best to follow the Prophet ﷺ's sunnah. The best way to do that is to actually follow it. The problem is, in America especially, like with me, I grew up here, so I used to go to Iqra Academy. It was a small school. I went there from like pre-K all the way up to fourth grade. It was an Islamic school. I actually got taught the religion the proper way. I was brought up with the love for the religion and not so much focused on, we're going to hell for this. The name mercy, like before you read any chapter in the Quran, you have to say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim in the name of the most merciful, the most benevolent. People tend to forget that, especially with radicalization. You have these people that were brought up and raised in an Islamic like setting that had no exposure to Islam whatsoever. When I transferred over to my other school, there were many other people that claimed to be Muslim. And you would see the super religious kids, you were close to them by name, and you were close to them by association, but you didn't really have much of a connection. You didn't have the same upbringing that they might have had. And then that's where the confusion comes through. Because I might go to this mosque, you might go to that mosque, we might connect sometimes, but even in and of itself, there is not one person that we go to. It's not like we have a pope, it's not like we have one person to like speak out for us. This person speaks for themselves, this person speaks for themselves. And sometimes that voice, somewhat, we get disconnected in the way we talk.
So it's very much like evangelical Christianity, where it's separate churches, yeah. And the same belief in scripture and, well, I guess not doctrine, but definitely scripture. Professor, anything to add on
yes,
what we've been talking about?
I actually would like to address what you said, which is why have Muslim leaders not basically condemned acts of terrorism? And that's actually erroneous completely. After every terrorist act anywhere around the world, you know, just let's keep with the American context. The most famous, well-known, and established Muslim American association in the U.S. or body, so to speak, is CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations. There hasn't been a single terrorist act from the smallest one to the biggest one where the leaders of CARE, including the present leader, Linda Sarsour, have not condemned vociferously. And going outside of the American context, there have been individual Muslims around the world, and I agree with Aman that Islam is a very personal religion. You know, it's almost like you have a direct line to God, you know, no intermediaries. And in many, 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 many cases, I want to say in almost every case, they have been condemned by individual Muslims, communities of Muslims, Muslim leaders. But the question is it always reflected in the media, in mainstream media? And the answer is no. And that's a problem.
I've also heard criticism of the media's, the language that we use in calling it Islamic State. Maybe there's another name.
ISIS?
Yeah.
Right. Well, they're calling themselves that, right?
Yeah.
They would love to be referred to as that, right?
Right.
Yeah. They would love to have the recognition.
We marked the 15th anniversary of 9/11 yesterday. And the FBI is reporting that anti-Muslim hate crimes are 5 times more frequent since that fateful day in 2001. How did the events of that day affect your life, the lives of people in Utah's Muslim community? Do you want to start us off?
So when that attack happened, I was like 3 years old, but my mom was at work at the time, and she was pregnant with my little brother. She was telling us, like, as soon as the attack happened, so they were on break and they could see the attack, there was a lady that would not stop swearing and just kept saying, oh, I'm going to get these Muslims, I'm going to get these Muslims. And so it was her and, like, all these other women, they were driving back home. They were in their scarves, and she could still hear people saying very hateful, cruel things. They were so tempted while they were at the red light. There was a guy that was super mad, and he had the news on. They had their window down. One of my mom's friends wanted to take the scarf off. They're just like, just let it be. You're pregnant with your kid. Don't risk it. She's like, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die regardless. My religion, I'm going to take it with me. And then my dad was also telling me about it, like all these, so he also worked at a similar company on the other side. They would also be saying all these rude stuff, like really rude stuff. Except he was saved because his beard is not as long, so he passed off as a normal African American. But his cousin right there, they were saying the most hateful stuff too. And the funny thing is, it actually got worse the year after. I still haven't experienced such hateful stuff. I mean, I get people that glare at me, but not to an extent that my mom and dad had it.
Hmm. What about you, Amr?
I was not here in America. I was right, in Egypt right. at that time.
Have you felt any difference from when you first came here in 2009 till today?
Yeah, I feel, actually, when I came here to Utah, it's different experience than being in North Carolina. So,
Better or worse?
Is a country by itself. So, no, here in Utah is way better than any other state. So, I never faced any, hate speech. I really like the place here. It's a very friendly for me as a person. Coming was my family and my wife as well. She was with me when we were in North Carolina, and she's with me now in Utah. And we find the place here is... I was actually at the beginning very scared because I know here is a red state. And I thought, okay, when I come here, they're going to kill me. So, but the opposite happened. The people here are very friendly. They are so open-minded. They are really accepting my religion, and I'm so grateful for here, for the church here, the LDS church, and all of the people around me, my neighbors, they are so nice to us. So
you don't feel it here?
No, I don't feel it.
Professor?
I'd like to second everything that Amr said. I've lived in a lot of different places in the U.S. I've lived most of my life in the U.S. I originally come from Iran. I'm from Tehran, Iran. And I do have to say, Utah, aside from being one of the wonders of the world, considering what we have, the national parks here just are amazing. In terms of something like being a person who was not born here, is Muslim, teaches about Islam, it's quite amazing. I mean, I do say all of that, and I kind of touch wood and say, let's not jinx it. I even tell that to my, to my Muslim American students. I remember 9/11 very well. I was pregnant with my daughter, and I lost a very close friend. Her name is Daria Lynn. You can check her out online. And she was an Iranian... An Iranian Burmese, we don't use the word Burma anymore, we say Myanmar. Mother, Iranian, father from Myanmar, both of them Muslim. She grew up in Iran and also in the US. She died in the towers. She was there for just a couple of days. She lived in Chicago and, basically... the way it happened is she was giving a seminar in the Twin Towers, and she wanted to make sure that everybody who was in that seminar, including a woman who was pregnant, had a chance to leave the building. And, as the story was told by survivors, doing that meant she didn't make it. And she was very young. She was only 30, Daria Lynn. So, obviously all of us, any kind of taking of human lives, it affects all of us. And 9/11 was just a, absolutely tragic event. And, we all know that. So many of you are very young, just like, Amal, and you don't remember it. But, those of us who are older, we remember it, we commemorate it, and...
Did your life fundamentally change, though, with that day?
So, it's. I remember it so very well, and I remember that in days kind of leading up to 9/11, I had this kind of portent of doom, listening to the news. I mean, I'm a news junkie, I have to say. I mean, I just... too much news probably. And there was stuff going on around the world, and it was all kind of just very scary. And some of the stuff was going on in Afghanistan, you know, including the basically the assassination of one of the political leaders in Afghanistan, Shah Massoud. And there was a kind of a, and of course we know from the record, you know, which, you know, from the records which have been released, that, you know, there was an anticipation of, you know, basically a tragedy on that scale. There was an anticipation, there was even warning to political leaders in this country about, you know, what was to come. So it is, you know, it is something that, you know, we really have to think about and, you know, hold some of these leaders accountable to. You know, when you read the records.
Let's talk politics, shall we? Donald Trump, of course, in December called for a complete shutdown of Muslims entering the U.S. in December. As I recall, he has not backed away from that pledge at all. In fact, he doubled down at convention. How is this political rhetoric, this heated rhetoric, affecting your community, Amal?
The fact that he gets to say all the stuff that he's saying so openly and he's getting support for it, and is by many others, he can say whatever he wants to say. People say that behind closed doors. They say whatever he's saying, it doesn't really matter. The people that are supporting him, that's what's scaring me the most. And the fact that he's willing to place a ban on people who are not coming here to hurt you or do anything. There's millions of Muslims security in the U.S. If we were, I admit there are those that wish to cause harm. People will cause harm regardless. If you put a block here, they'll come some other way. But do not put those lives that actually do need that help and put them pretty much as, I don't know how to explain that, like, don't barter their lives, don't play with it. Play your politics elsewhere. It's between you and those world leaders, and it's between you and those people that you actually wish to get in a fight with. Don't put those people in between you guys. They've done nothing to you, and they don't, the likelihood that they actually will do something to you is slim to none. And I feel like the fact that he's being openly saying that stuff is just ridiculous.
So, Amr, why shouldn't there be a religious test to letting people in to the U.S.?
Because this is U.S. This is United States of America. You know, this is a place where, as I was saying just like 15 minutes ago, when I came here in 2009, I was freely practicing my religion. I did not have the same freedom in practicing my religion at my country, which has a majority of Muslims, and which is in everywhere is like a Muslim country or majority Muslim country. I did not have the same freedom in practicing my religion that I had it when I came here to the United States. And adding to what she was saying, Amal, that, you know, it's what scares me that, okay, the basic rule of freedom that everyone can say whatever he thinks. So it comes to the action whenever you stop someone from practicing their freedom. This should be full stop. This is a stop. You should not do that. You should not stop others from freely practicing their religion or freely expressing their opinions. Having said, as a candidate for presidency and as a major party candidate, and saying that and seeing after that in polls he increased by 10 points in just the second day, this is what scares me as a person. And me as a person, I'm not from that country. I would think, okay, then whenever I finish my degree, I will go and travel to Canada. It's a better place, and people there are still having freedom. And if a person like him succeeded at the elections, that means this is not the America that I came when I came at the first time in 2009.
Professor, are Muslims in America scared about the future?
I think so. I think they are. I know that one of the, I can't remember which media outlet it was, but at some point, I think it was in the spring, you know, one of the main channels did a, you know, basically a kind of a sit down with some Muslims, and you know, from everything that I read and also just things going on, including just today. I don't know if any of you has had a chance to, I mean, you've all probably been pretty busy, but so I don't know whether you have checked the news online, but so in Orlando, Florida, where the massacre happened at the Pulse nightclub, last night there was basically the torching of the mosque. And, you know, the head of the police department in Fort Pierce was, I mean, this was in Fort Pierce, rather, not in Orlando. Very close. You know, they're very, very unhappy. And obviously this is, you know, and it's right at the anniversary of 9/11. So the police department in Florida, they're, you know, very concerned and they're looking into it. And there have been many instances of Muslim getting harassed and I'm very happy that, you know, Utah, I mean, and again, I don't want to jinx it, you know, I'm always very happy that, you know, we, the three of us, live in a community, you know, where at least I sense and have sensed for the past many years, tolerance, you know, and you know, basically the majority community here has a sense of what it means to be, to have prejudice against it, as a result of which they're welcoming to refugees and to people who are in, you know, minority communities. But it is absolutely concerning. But I do want to just, you know, quickly, I do want to say again, you know, reiterating what Amal said, it's ultimately it's the support for, you know, the platform of someone like Trump that is concerning. And I mean, I also do want to kind of connect it to extremism and extreme rhetoric all over the world. You know, we're not the only country where we're seeing these extreme rhetorics and call for extreme action. So that's one part of it. And I think another part of it is, you know, I do think about, you know, and wonder about some of the issues that people are obviously very frustrated and angry about, you know, and you know, for example, the refugee issue connected to Europe. I mean, you know, I do kind of wonder about it. And in the case of America, you know, let's say you're a white male, white middle-aged male, and you know, working to make ends meet, and the dollar, you know, your money is not going as far as it used to. You know, you and you know, the young people here, most of you are young people. I mean, I worry about all of you, and the fact that, you know, do you in fact have the opportunities that your parents and your grandparents had? And you know, things are concerning, very concerning.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just tuning in, we are airing a forum that was recorded on Monday this week about being Muslim in America. The panelists include Dr. Sohaila Amir Soleimani. She's an associate professor of Persian in the Department of World Languages at the University of Utah. Amal Sharif. She's an executive board member of the Muslim Students Associations at the U. And Amir Abdelghani. He's the acting president of the Muslim Student Association, and he's an immigrant from Egypt. This discussion was moderated by the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, Jennifer Napier Pierce.
I would love to hear what's on your mind. This is being recorded, right? Is there a microphone that's going around? Excellent. Wait for the microphone. Raise your hand if you've got a question.
If you could just say your name and a little bit about yourself.
My name is Joel Gardner. I'm a political science and psychology major at the U. And I have kind of a policy question for you. What policies would you recommend, what foreign policies towards majority Islamic nations would you support to improve the relations between the United States and Islamic countries?
Yeah, it's a mess, you know, and I'm really happy I'm not a political science major or professor, you know, and you know, have no kind of claim to knowing what the right course is. You know, and at this point, you know, I mean, what I see is, you know, a complete mess from decades of kind of wrong policy. So, and I know that people of your generation are so fed up, you know, with all sorts of decisions that, you know, people of my generation and older have made. And I have so much sympathy for that. You know, I'm not really, you know, I mean, I really am not sure if, you know, I have any clue. I mean, I'm as befuddled by the whole thing as everybody else. You know, there are people whose kind of, you know, whose reading of situations I respect, you know, and you know, I read them. I mentioned one of them, that's Olivier Roy. I would definitely suggest his works. I mean, what is America to do at this point, considering, you know, the mess that's going on in Syria, in Iraq? Libya is a basket case, you know, Yemen, you know, and I want to pose whatever I think in terms of questions, because I don't really feel like I have answers. You know, I do wish, and I'm hoping that you young people, you're going to be the ones who are going to keep the feet of politicians in this country and decision makers in this country to the fire. I hope America would start kind of cutting relations with Saudi Arabia, which is one of the main culprits, and the government of Saudi Arabia never gets questioned in terms of the mainstream media in this country. They have done so much damage to their own population. They're doing so much damage to Yemen, and our leaders in this country, they refuse to basically even question them. And that is, you know, and of course we know what the political situation is, right? You know, okay, the Saudis and the Americans, and it's against the government of Iran. You know, I mean, these are all culprits. You know, government of Iran, government of Saudi Arabia, you know, our own government. But I think that, you know, cutting, you know, not supporting Saudi Arabia as we have been for many, many decades, you know, I wonder whether that can, in fact, change the paradigm of thinking and, as a result, you know, change things dramatically. I mean, I by no means feel that I can even address something like Syria. What is, you know, what is anybody supposed to do?
What is Aleppo anyway? Just kidding. All right.
You know, I have to say, you guys, do you guys know the story? Yeah. Gary Johnson. Everybody knows it, right? Just in case you didn't hear it, poor Gary Johnson, who's the
libertarian
candidate, was in an interview with MSNBC, was it?
I believe so.
And the interviewer said, "What do you think about Aleppo?" And he's like, "What is Aleppo?" I do want to say, I know everybody has made fun of him. People are just kind of like, how could he be the candidate for president? I mean, maybe he had a moment. I mean, do we not, all of us, forget out of context a word? I mean, poor guy. You know, I mean, I have sympathy for him. You know, that's kind of a marginal thing. But yeah, I mean, I don't think people should jump down his throat. You know, he probably does know. He just kind of, you know, they're on the kind of a lecture circuit all the time. We should be compassionate, you know, even to, you know, Trump and Gary Johnson and Hillary Clinton and the rest.
Yes, please.
So, actually, as a person who lived in the Middle East, before I came here, I hated America. And it's not only me. I would say this is just like, you know, the general feeling among the people of the Middle East, they hate America.
Why?
Because what they see that America is doing, what the government of America is doing, support for regimes, support for dictator regimes, they never see any good from America as a country. When America is involved in anything, just involved like with death, death of millions of people in Iraq, death of wars like that. What happens in Syria? People are blaming America because they did not stop Assad regime from flying with the airplanes and killing people in Aleppo and killing innocent people in everywhere in Syria, and they did not just stop him from doing that. Although they did the same with Gaddafi in Libya and stopped the killing of millions of people in Libya, which happened in Syria. They did not stop it. So as a person, before I came here in 2009, I hated America. And when I came here, my personal point of view changed it. Okay, I hate the government of America. And those are completely different things. The people of America, the majority, the Americans themselves, they are very good people. They are open-minded to others. They like to know about others. They don't care about politics. They don't care about anything outside of their country. They just like to enjoy the life. They like living like any regular human. And they are completely different from the government of America. So when I returned back to Egypt, and people around me was like, you know, insulting America, and I would say, okay, guys, the American government is different from America. America is American people, and American people are very good people. So my advice for your question, which is how we can solve that, if you guys by any way able of making friendship with the people of the Middle East, this is gonna change everything. Because the problem that here in America they are dealing with the Middle East as like those group of governments who govern by the weapon and govern by prisons and govern by the rockets which were given as a gift from America and military aid from America. You guys are looking to those countries as like the group of that, the group of king and his family in Saudi Arabia, the group of Byzantine and army in Egypt, the army in Syria, the army. So you guys do not look to the people. They govern millions of people. And those millions of people hating America, they will continually hate America until they understand that the American people is different from the American government. So what I'm calling for, which is little, I would say, extremely difficult, to have friendship with the people. Because the government will change. But in the Middle East, they never change. They change from bad to worse because dictator regimes. If by any way in the Middle East they had a democracy, and I really doubt, if they had at any time at the coming like 100 years, have a democracy, support that democracy, and make the people build on that democracy. And until that time comes, do not just stop and looking to the Middle East at the government. Look to the people. Allow more people to interact with you, just like meet them in like a conference in another country and talk to them and let them know you as a people. Let them come for like 2 weeks, spend 2 weeks with an American family. Support those programs by giving financial aid to those programs that allow youth from those countries to come here and stay for a short period. I'm not going to say let them stay here. This is dangerous. Okay, don't bring them. Okay, this is what they say at the media. But let them come and live for like 1 month or 2 months. Let them understand that freedom is sweet. This is what I understand. And this is why I like this country. So,
Amal, anything before we go to another question?
I would suggest that rather than quickly giving military aid to certain countries, like what happened in Somalia, sure, there might be rebels and they might be trying to overthrow an oppressive regime. They also turn quickly on you as well. They too will become that oppressive regime. Al-Shabaab has used many of the military aid the Americans have given them and used it against their own people. Many of the, what do you call it, terrorist groups have also done the exact same thing. Try to overthrow one regime, brings in another. rather than providing military aid, provide aid as in writing up a constitution, writing up some sort of document that all people agree on, not just a certain group of people. What happened in Somalia, I'm Somali, that's it, but what happened in Somalia was that when we did give military aid to Al-Shabaab, they used it against in tribal wars. And majority of the time, they will use that weapon. Sure, they might try to bring about change, but that change will be limited towards getting revenge on those who oppressed them first. Not just that dictatorship, but also other tribes and other cultures, which is really prevalent in the Middle East, East Coast Africa, and many other Islamic countries.
Jane, how long do we have? One more question.
I'm Katie Egbert, and I'm an international studies major. And the question that I have, I kind of will just pose really quickly with a thought. It's interesting that when we talk about Muslims, that we immediately just think about the Middle East, but we know that the majority of Muslims actually live in Southeast Asia, most importantly in Indonesia. So I think it's interesting that immediately when people think of Muslims that we automatically go to the Middle East. And so my question, though, do you ever see an end in sight about Americans that we classify, which is kind of difficult to do because there's not really one way to classify who is American. But do you think there's ever end in sight about being kind of this target of focus? Just thinking back, Revolutionary War, Americans and the British. I don't think today any of us are kind of looking at the British with this hateful attitude. World War II with Germans, we don't always want to associate every German with Nazis. Red Scare, Russians, Soviet Union. Do you ever see that there's an end in sight that you are no longer going to be? I don't want to say there's another group that we need to target or blame because that's horrible, but do you ever see any new sight, end in sight that one day that it's going to pass, or is this going to continue because of oppression and differences with Christianity and Islamic religion? Did you address
that? Yes, I'm an optimist, and I do think that you know, I do see an end in sight, but I'm also in some ways cynical, and I wonder whether yet another group will be the object of, you know, the ire and hatred or bigotry. I mean, I personally feel that, you know, since your question is kind of about the future, you know, where are things going? And, I mean, I'm one of those people, and, you know, obviously do not agree with Trump, that, no, I think, in fact, one of the problems that we all have to, you know, really think about and try and find solutions to has to do with the environment. And, you know, we all share it. You know, there isn't a safe haven on the planet where you can go and just basically be immune from the mess that we have created. You know, as a result of which, you know, when you think about kind of the bigger paradigm, which is the environment, you kind of wonder, you know, it's almost like going to the top of the mountain. Your perspective really changes from when you are, you know, at the bottom of the mountain, you know, and you, things which seemed problematic, you know, maybe they don't seem problematic anymore. In some sense, I mean, we really have to all come together, you know, in terms of solutions to the problem of the environment and, you know, all of these squabbles and conflicts and, you know, problems that are of our own creation, they have to go away because we have a much bigger fish to fry. That's my sense, at least. And I know there are people who do not agree. I completely understand that. Did you want to hammer,
Amal?
Yeah, I won't
nothing to add?
Yeah.
Not really.
Okay. Well, I guess our time is up. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You want another?
I just want to add one announcement. It's for the Muslim Student Association. So the Muslim Student Association will have the Islam Awareness Week, which is a week of events on campus. And it will be starting the week of October 23rd, so 2 weeks after the fall break. So we will have a lot of events on campus to increase awareness about Islam. And all of the events will have some sort of forum where people can ask questions for the Muslim students or ask for our guest speakers. We will bring local and nationwide imams to come here and speak to the students. Also, we will have the annual blood drive during that week with the ASUU. It's going to be a bus in front of the bookstore, October 25th. This is going to be Tuesday. So please come to our events. Please tell the people about us and like our Facebook page, Muslim Student Association, University of Utah. Please ask us and come to us whenever you have question about Muslims or about Islam. Don't hear about us. Come to talk about us. We are reachable. We are here and everywhere. We have a lot of board members around here. We have Rasmin here. Rasmin, Irshad at the very backyard. And we have Amal here. And we have a lot of active board member. This year, there are 10 students, and all of them have a lot of energy. Just come and ask us.
Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking our guests today.
Thank you to Dr. Sohaila Amir Soleimani, Amal Sharif, and Amir Abdelghani for participating in this discussion, and for Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce for moderating the conversation. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.